At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, an Emory education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.
I always had a private doctor. I didn't think I needed VA care. Then I learned VA is ranked above private care systems nearby and costs less. I'm getting the best care of my life with providers trained to treat veterans. Get what you earn. Visit choose.va.gov.
Not all veterans are eligible for the type or amount of benefits mentioned here.
Hey guys, welcome back to another episode of Shut Your Face with your host, me, Bree. Thank you so much for subscribing to this and listening to this and being supportive of this. It means the absolute world. It's the coolest thing ever. So thank you so much for listening to our podcast. Let's get into it.
Miss Shannon Kerr is here. I tried to talk to you a while ago because I just thought it was... I found you through this post that you obviously remember because everybody and their brother was commenting on it. You had done a video about a barrel race down there. And Facebook just kind of went a little crazy off of how things are so much different where you are versus where we are in the United States. Did you think that that video would get a lot of traction, or did you just... You just said...
Well, I had had some people ask me about, like, the bits. Like, why do we have certain bits we can use and ones we can't? And I don't know why. I think they just try to follow AQHA rules. So I was doing this show that it was actually Brazil's largest incentive because I was the president and founder. So I was there, and I was like, hey, let's just go make a video real quick and show everybody, like, what we have to go through here. And, yeah, it really took off, and... lots of comments. A lot of people are like, oh, I wouldn't run there. I wouldn't do that. But you do. I mean, if you want to run, you follow the rules, you know?
I think it's cool. I think it's cool as hell. Because when I saw it, I actually saw it on TikTok. And I thought it was really cool because I think it maybe or should, it should maybe humble the United States barrel racing a little bit. Because we do have it very, I don't want to say easy, but it is easier compared to other places.
It is, you know, the thing about Brazil is it's very professionalized. Like, there's one main association that controls everything, pretty much. There are some small branches like rodeos. They don't control rodeos and stuff. But everything, even though it's like an association, it has to follow the ABQM rules. And the ABQM is like the Quarter Horse Association of Brazil. And they just have these really strict rules. But, you know, once you learn them, it's really not that bad. You just deal with it. And I remember I've only been asked to weigh one time, and I wanted to hug the judge. I was like, please ask me to weigh.
Yeah, no, that's crazy because it's like, you know, which is probably a good thing because we don't, I mean, I don't want to get into that and offend people when I say that, you know, that should be a thing, but just to see the difference, the sheer difference between a lot of the rules that are down there versus the rules that are up here, did those just kind of come about because of things that happened to make things better? And do you think that, like, do you think America should kind of catch up on that?
I don't think that you have a good enough organization to do it. You know, there's not, like, a governing body over barrel racing, so it would be really hard to enforce it. And, you know, we have judges at every event, even rodeos, we have judges. So it would be really hard for that to be enforced there. I don't think it would ever work or go over well there because of that, because you don't have the organization and you don't have the judge system in place. So I think it's just one of those things. And I think it came about here because of, I think just from, they kind of took everything kind of from the AQHA Association and from horse racing and then just developed these rules over time to try to make it fair. I mean, that's when I asked them, like, why do we have the bits? Why do we have the weighing? Why do we have this? And they're like, to try to make it fair as possible.
You would think other people would get on board with that. That's pretty common sense. So now back out of this, how did you end up there? Because you are originally from the United States.
Yeah, I'm from Oklahoma. I married a Brazilian.
Oh.
So he lived and worked in Texas for 20 years. And then when I met him, he he has such an interesting life too. He saved his money. He never went on vacation, never bought a house. He never bought a fancy car or truck. He shod horses in North Texas and was one of the main shoers there. He shod for Tim McQuay and Ron Rawls and all those big names there in North Texas. And he would just send his money back to Brazil and buy cattle. And so one day he said, you know, Shannon, I have like 1,200 head of cattle and some bulls that are doing really well in the semen stations. And I see how you live your life every day, you know, like you try to make the most out of every day. And that's inspired me. So I want to retire shoeing horses and go back to manage my cattle in Brazil and want you to go with me.
Well, there you go. That was a love story.
Yeah, yeah, it's kind of like a fairy tale.
But so did he shoe your horses, I'm taking?
Well, that's how I met him, but he doesn't know. Once we moved here, forget it. No, I have to pay someone.
It's probably
better for the relationship anyway. Now, yeah. If I get in a bind or an emergency, sure, he'll help me out. You know, like if a horse loses a shoe before an event or something, he'll go tack it on, but he doesn't like to do it.
Now, it's not just barrel racing down there. I mean, Brazil has cutting down there. They've got reiners down there. They've got all types of everything going on down there. Do you see the same differences in those disciplines that you, I mean, if you ever run across it, is it like that kind of across the board for all horse people down there or no?
I think so. You know, there's a lot of money here in the horse world. And so these guys, it's such a great environment to be in because you're around these very professional people. And I don't mean like trainers, I mean like owners and breeders. And because they do have the financial means that, you know, they breed the best of the best to the best and then hire the best trainer to put on these horses. And the level just explodes. Excuse me, I got a cough in Canada and I cannot seem to kick it. But
wait, did you just say Canada?
Yeah, I gave 8 clinics in Canada.
Oh my gosh.
Okay. Got cold.
I'm going to have to come back. I got to come back around to that. I got a question. Go ahead.
So anything here in the horse world on any discipline, whether it's jumping or anything, it's just they take it to another level. Let me turn my phone off the sound so nobody calls me. They just know how to get to the next level, and a lot of them have the financial means to get there. And it's not drug money or nothing, not like what you think of Mexicans. These are just guys with big ranches or big businesses. And the thing people need to realize about Brazil is we don't have a lot of extracurricular activities. Like, I know there's some golf courses, but not many, and only near a big, big city. There's not like bowling or ice skating or,
really?
You know, so yeah. So the main hobbies in Brazil are horses and soccer. So
okay.
The horse industry here in all kinds of things, not just quarter horses, but in all types, it's just huge. You know, it's just one of the main hobbies that people have.
I didn't know this. That's so interesting. I know that, like, you know, things sell in Brazil. So a lot of stuff sells in Brazil. But back to the Canada thing. So hold on a second. How did you end up in Canada? Do you do worldwide clinics?
Yeah, I do a lot of clinic. Well, the clinic thing just kind of happened. And then I guess they go well because, like, now whenever a clinic opens up, it literally sells out the same day.
Oh, sweet. No,
it's
that's good.
Incredible. Yeah, so I just came back from doing 8 clinics in Canada.
Holy cow. They're like, we're only here in the United States, but it's very, very big in other places. And so that's interesting about Brazil only being the only hobbies because I didn't know that. I think that's cool as hell to know.
No, there's, you know, if you get into the bigger cities, there's a little bit of basketball, a little bit of this, a little bit of that, but not anything like in America.
So are
not
you near,
all.
I'm going to say this wrong, San Paul?
São Paulo,
okay.
That's how it's pronounced. I'm in the state of São Paulo. It's kind of like Oklahoma City, Oklahoma.
Oh.
So you have São Paulo City, which is the capital city of São Paulo State, and it's the third largest city in the world with 13 million people. It's big. It may even have more than that. It's big. It's the third largest city in the world. But I live about 400 miles from there.
Oh, okay.
I live out in the country.
But you can still get... Okay, so you're not, like, out in the middle of nowhere. You can get to there if you need to. That's cool.
Brazil's more modern than what people think.
Yeah, it's real. Yeah, no, I'm totally agreeing with you because it's... I don't want to say it's shocking because you don't want to sound naive, but it is naive for me to say. You're like, oh, okay, you know, we didn't know other people lived like us, I guess.
Yeah, it's pretty incredible.
Yeah.
Still behind, but...
So did you grow up around horses your whole life, or did you...
No. No, my mom left when I was 2. I was adopted to begin with, so she wasn't my birth mother, but...
Oh, wow.
So I was raised by my father, and he was a policeman and killed when I was 11. So his parents raised me, which are my grandparents. And then they passed away. By the time I was 20, I had lost both of them. So I've been pretty much on my own since I was 20.
Holy cow.
Put myself through school. But they knew I loved horses. I loved horses. You know, when you're born with it, you're just born with it.
Yeah.
But they wanted me to play golf. I was a good golfer, and my grandfather was president of the country club. And
yeah.
They were like, be a professional golfer. But I was just too enamored by horses. So I started out galloping race horses on a local track near my house just so I could ride. And that's kind of how it all started.
That's badass. You've raised yourself pretty much. Like that's pretty, I think those types of people that have been through those types of environments in life or experienced it, you're a lot more open-minded and you're a lot more like understanding of other places
yeah.
and things. Whereas you ever meet people that are not, I don't want to say were raised better, but like in better conditions, they're not necessarily apt to know other things that go on. They're just not as, I don't know the right word that I'm trying to say.
Well, they've never been maybe put in the situation to.
Right.
Or maybe their life is so good they can't imagine it being better in another way.
Right.
You know?
Or bad. Or have to go
or
through
bad,
something bad.
Yeah.
Because yeah. that brings me into the recent post I happened to run across, which made me message you actually again the second time. I had seen this girl make this post about your post about how taking your frustrations out on horses. And I was like, I can totally understand. I can understand both viewpoints, but I can definitely understand because we're humans. And
yeah.
it's very much human nature to get frustrated and pull back and go, oh, crap, I shouldn't have done that. You know,
yeah.
like, I think that's very relatable. And it's good to see that from somebody in your stance to kind of relate to the same thing that other people, you know, non-professional, I guess, can.
You know, what I see a lot at clinics and what brought about that post is, and I think the reason the clinics are successful is, one, I ride every horse and I work every horse until it's good, and then I put the rider back on. And then I have to explain to the rider what to do, and then they figure it out. And it made me realize that there's no bad riders at these clinics. There's just people that they don't have any help. They don't know where to go to get help, or they've never been in that situation. You know, I've rode so many horses in my life. Like, just in Canada, I rode 65 horses.
Holy
so
God.
I've just sat on a lot of horses. I've been through everything you can imagine, and I've done it the wrong way, and then I've had to figure it out and do it the right way. And so at the clinics, I always tell them, I'm not a better rider than you, or I've just been where you're at and I've been able to get through it, and let me help you get through it faster. And the reason I made that post is I'm struggling with a horse right now in a situation that I hadn't been in. And it made me relate back to the girls at my clinics, like, man, I'm so frustrated that I don't know what to do. And then maybe you do something on that horse that you regret, and you realize that wasn't the right thing to do. And then you feel bad.
Yeah.
You know, it doesn't mean you were beating them, but maybe, you know, you yank them around or you put a spur and then you didn't get the response you wanted. And then you're like, man, I did all that and it still didn't work. And it's just a frustration that fortunately I don't feel very often. But it made me relate to my students when I put them back on the horses and asked them to do some really hard moves and maneuvers, which was what I do. I really try to take everything up a level with them. And I wasn't even mean to my horse or anything, but I at that moment, I felt the frustration that they feel, you know?
Yeah, no, absolutely. I saw it and I was like, oh my God, this is, one, really cool to see somebody of, again, your position relate to the same thing, because, you know, it's very easy to be a professional out here in any industry, not just horses, and proclaim to be perfect and this is how it is and da 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 da, like, you know, you're wrong if you're not doing it this way, and we don't make any mistakes. So it's cool to see that that's relatable, because I remember times when I rode where you get so frustrated, you're just like, you just, I mean, no human being would be able to handle their emotion. My mom has literally used to come out when I was a teenager and say, get off that horse right now. Put her up and get off. You're frustrated. You're doing no good. You know?
Yeah.
And, but it's because you want to do it right. You want to get somewhere, you know, as a rider, me saying, you know, you want to progress and you're not. And it's frustrating because it ain't like you can sit there and talk to the horse with reason and, you know, they're not going to talk back to you.
And even in the case, not even that, sometimes it's the case of, like, what I had answered her even on that post was, I know this horse has the talent. Like, I know he can do it. And he wasn't. And I was like, what do I have to do to get it out of you? You know, do I have to really, you know, jam my spur inside of you? And I don't want to, I don't like to do that,
yeah.
you know? And then sometimes it's not even about us. It's about, golly, come on, horse. I know you can do it. I know you've got this.
Yeah.
You know, and then they just, they don't give it to you and you get frustrated and we all cry.
Yeah.
I don't care who you are. There are days that you just sit at your trailer or in your barn and you cry. And that's what makes this sport so amazing and allow us to grow as people.
Do you think, you know, horses kind of pulled you from the way that you were brought up and having losing so many close, you know, what would be close people for most others? Do you think horses kind of pulled you out of that and helped keep you in a way where?
For sure. I think if it wouldn't have been for horses, I probably would have been on the street either with drugs or prostitute or something, because I had nobody to go to. Fortunately, the education and growing up that I had with my grandparents and what they gave me, you know, also kept me from that. If I wouldn't have had my grandparents, I probably would be on the streets, no question.
Yeah.
No question. But they were very elegant people. My grandfather, he retired from Coors Beer. He was their advertising director. They were very elegant people. And I had a really great childhood. I was class president. I made straight A's. I was basketball, softball, golf. You know, I had a really amazing childhood. And then I think the harder part about that was one day it was amazing and then the next day it's gone. You know, I was working three jobs to pay my way through college. I remember I would go days without eating, you know, just to make it. But it was so weird because when I look back on it, I was always still really happy and positive and had a great outlook. But I have a lot of faith too.
Right, right.
But for sure, if it weren't for horses, maybe I would in a different place probably.
Yeah. I mean, that's a and you know, I don't know, for you, is it frustrating for you to see people that maybe have, they got it made, they got it laid out right in front of them and they still don't appreciate it versus what you've been through to get to where you're at? Because you've literally went from, like, I don't want to say nothing, but to this, I mean, like, you own your own company.
Yeah.
And you put on these clinics and you do all this stuff, you know, so it, is that frustrating for you to see people kind of just not appreciate what they have, especially in the horse industry?
Yeah, it's not even about, and I've never been jealous of people that have things, you know. In fact, I even made a post once, like, if somebody buys that 1D horse or buys that new truck or trailer, no matter their financial condition, you should congratulate them, because no matter where they are in life, that's still a sacrifice and something that they had to do or work for, or someone in their family had to sacrifice for. And I've always admired and looked up to people that had things better than me instead of being jealous. But I think what frustrates me the most is more like, you have this amazing animal with you and it doesn't matter what truck or trailer you have it. And the 90% of the rest of the world, they don't even have that.
Yeah.
So you shouldn't compare yourself to somebody else. You should strive to be like that. Like, if I see somebody with a fancy rig, like, okay, I want to work towards that.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, I look at it more as, like, not competition, but as a, wow, I can do that too. If they can do it, I can do it. If
yeah.
you can do it, I can do it.
Yeah.
And when I see that people don't, let's say, not appreciate things, I feel more bad for them because there's so much good in their life and they're not seeing it.
Yeah.
You know, like, I see the good in everything. It's kind of a problem sometimes.
No, that's a good thing. I'm glad you said that, because it's very easy in any sports-related industry for things to become a competition, even if you don't want them to, because I totally agree with you. It's like, it's not, especially girls, too, you know, not that guys aren't any better, they
yes.
do it, but with the girls, you can get into competitions that you didn't even know existed, and it can be frustrating because, you know, if we worked together, we could get here instead of being against each other and staying here, you know.
And I think that's one thing that Brazil has really taught me this a lot, because you don't have the drama here that I see in the States. You don't have the jealousy. And I don't know if it's because it's mostly men. Like, last Saturday, I was at a competition, or last Thursday, I was at a competition. It was a 3 or 4 day race. I was there for 2 days exhibitioning 3-year-olds. I was the only girl there, the only one.
Oh, wow.
I was literally surrounded by 150 men, you know, and Brazil is so interesting because, for example, I have this one horse and I asked a really top trainer there. It was in during the exhibitions, and I said, hey, will you run this horse through so I can see how she goes? And because it was a horse that whenever I would turn her loose, she would act like she wanted to buck with me. And so I was a little bit scared to turn her loose.
Yeah.
And I told him that, and I said, I'm a little bit scared to just turn her loose. I'm scared she may buck with me. Do you mind to ride her? And he did, and it was amazing. And he came back, he said, wow, what a nice horse. She's so light. She doesn't drop. She does wherever I put her. And I said, okay, you help me get over this fear of just, you know, really turning her loose. So I get on her to do my exhibition, and he tells me, he's on another horse nearby, and he said, Shannon, just trust her, just send her, just send her. And I go to take off, and he's like, just send her, just let her go, just trust her. And I mean, he supported me through the whole run, you know? And then I'd been at another race, and there was a really big top trainer, and he said, you know, Shannon, of all the colts here, you have the best colts. Of all of us, yours are the best. And there's just a camaraderie that I see here that I don't feel when I'm there. Yeah. That makes me kind of sad.
Yeah.
You know?
It can be really catty. It can be a little too much, and it's almost like, you know, it can be, because even like I could totally relate, not necessarily riding horses, but like just in business in general. I get further in business with people, like as far as orders or sponsorships or whatever, if it's a male. And I hate to say that, because I'm all for women empowerment. I'm all for like females doing their thing, you know, but it's like when you get a female involved, sometimes it's just unnecessary emotion and drama that it's tiring, really. You don't even want to deal with it.
Yeah. So I have to tell myself this a lot. Like my husband, he's very Mr. Common Sense and very, very calm. You know, he's a cattle rancher, very calm guy. And I always have to tell myself, okay, what would Jake do? What would Jake do? And I tell the girls who work for me, I said, sometimes try to think like a man and not a woman, because we react with our emotions.
Yeah.
Instead of just, you know, using our common sense sometimes. So we all get caught up in that, and I have to tell myself, okay, what would Jake do? Think like a man. Don't act like a woman. You know, come back, Shannon, come back.
Right.
You know?
Back to reality. Calm down. Walk away a little
yeah.
bit.
Yeah. And so I think Brazil, that's what I love about Brazil, too, is like in America, we are stress. It's work, work, work. You know, we live to work. And here in Brazil, we work to live. So we all work. But they know how to stop. At the end of the day is the end of the day. And let's spend time with our family, a drink, let's do this. And there's times when it's like, in the past, when I was in the States, it was like, okay, I have to get this done. And then living here, the guys are like, well, do you have to? Nobody's going to die, right? Like, if you send that email tomorrow, it's not going to change if you send it tonight at 6 or if you send it tomorrow at 9, right?
Right.
And I'm like, no. Well, then just wait till tomorrow. I don't know. Here, there's a little bit of better quality of life in the sense of that. Like, you really live your life here. Whereas in America, it's just, you know, just got to work. You got to keep up with the Joneses. And, you know, it's just very stressful.
I can feel that. I can definitely feel that. I believe you. Now, I wanted to also kind of touch base on back to, you know, how you grew up and you wasn't around horses. What was your first horse? What did you first initially do when it come to horse? Did you go straight into barrel racing, or did you?
No. So I remember I bought a horse for $600 off a paper ad back in the day when there were newspapers.
I remember that.
And I didn't tell my I didn't tell my grandparents. I was working at Sonic part-time, and I saved all my tips, and I bought this $600 horse and never told them. And he was this paint horse that almost killed me. And I ended up making him a really great pony horse.
Oh, cool.
And so he actually later on made me money and used him as a pony horse on the track. And then my very first barrel horse was, and how I got into barrels was, I was dating a saddle bronc rider. And I would go to the rodeos with him and be like, oh man, you know, I'm jumping big fences and galloping racehorses. I had gotten to jumping horses by then.
Oh, cool.
So I can do this too. So he had a rope horse, and I trained that rope horse, and that was my first barrel horse.
I don't know much about rodeo, obviously. I grew up like 4-H and fun shows all around and stuff like that. But I have seen kind of on Facebook where people are saying a lot of the rope horses are starting to breed like barrel horses, and barrel horses are going into rope horses because of the speed and stuff. So that's probably a really good thing that kind of intertwines for you as far as rope horses and barrel horses.
Yeah. Yeah, it did then. I filled my permit on that horse in the first year I ran. You know, so he was really good, Mr. Solid, 1D, top 2D horse. And then I bought a $2,500 mare out of a sale and trained her, and she did really well. And then I bought a blown up mare for $6,500, put her on my credit card, and then ended up selling her for $30,000. And that's kind of how all this started. So I train them and sell them, and then that's kind of how it all got rolling.
Holy cow, that was really good. you just made me think about something as far as what is, you know, for somebody that wants to come into the barrel racing world that's brand new and never done it, what's the biggest piece of advice that you would give them, young or old, no matter, but just anybody that's never touched barrels?
Well, you know, it's a little bit hard because I do feel like a lot of the people that are really professional are a little bit cold and hard to get close to. And that could just be me and my impression. So it would be really hard for me to say, go find a really great trainer and ride with them and stay with them, because I know that's not real feasible in the United States. Not like maybe it is here, you know. So the biggest thing I would say is, oh man, this is a great question. If I had to give advice to somebody, one, get good equipment, even if it's just one saddle and one bridle, you know, get something with good leather, buy a good brand of saddle. Don't skimp on equipment. Like me, forever, I had like 19 horses in training and I had one saddle, but it was one good saddle.
Oh, yeah. So
definitely invest in good equipment if you can, but you got to know what that good equipment is. That's where this catch is. Like, if you're into it, like, what is good equipment? You know, I don't know.
Yeah. Do your research.
Try to do your research. Maybe try to subscribe to people like myself or some of the other professionals that have that type of access. You know, watch a lot of training videos. When I first started, what I did is I watched the NFR over and over, and I watched Sherry Servey because I was tall. I'm tall like she is. I was a quiet rider because of my English writing background. So I really watched just over and over and over her runs. So I would almost say like that, like find some video where you're only watching good runs and watch the best and what they do. Like if someone were to ask me, I'd say, watch Cassie Mallory, watch Sherry Servey, watch Brittany Posey. You know, I really like to, even to this day, I really like to watch the girls that are able to keep it going on different horses and have kept a career for a long time. So I really admire them and like to, even to this day, I watch them. Now, one advantage I have here in Brazil is when I go to a race, everybody's a professional. It's not like America where you have the 60-year-old lady and the 10-year-old kid and you've got the 4 and 5D horse that lopes in there. We don't have that here. Every horse that runs down that alleyway is a 1D horse.
Oh, wow.
So when I'm here and when I'm doing exhibitions or I'm in the warm-up pen or I'm at a race, I'm surrounded by literally a bunch of top professionals. So I can see what they're doing, watch what they're doing, go home, try to mimic what they're doing. Or even in the case of Brazil, I feel comfortable enough to ask them and they're nice enough to tell me. So I have that advantage. So in that case, you know, they could go to a show or go to a rodeo and watch what these people do, or get the videos from, say, like the NFR and just watch over and over and over the runs, or like the American is a great rodeo to watch, great runs over and over and over, and just really try to get your eye good. You know, I feel like I have been blessed with a good eye. So I've learned from watching.
Yeah.
You know, I had never been to a clinic. I just learned from watching people and still do to this day learn from watching.
Yeah, that's funny you talked about that, because I have talked about it a lot, how in America, obviously in America, we don't have any like license. We don't have any requirements to be a trainer. You can literally go up the road and some Joe Blow could just tell you, hey, I'm a professional barrel racing trainer. And then next thing you know, you got all kinds of problems. So you are right. It can be a very mix of all different kinds of people, which isn't necessarily good or bad. You know, we need all of them in the industry. But do you think that affects as far as the mentality? It seems like a professional mentality is going to be more open to learn versus a mentality that's like, you know, you see a lot of people even on the internet as far as not just barrel racing, but all horse disciplines. They know it all when they really don't know anything. And so it's hard to.
Yeah, that's the problem is when they think they know it all. Like even me, here I am. We literally have 25 horses here that we're training. I give clinics. I rodeoed and barrel raced literally all over the world, and I still feel like I have so much to learn.
Yeah.
So and I think even that thing I know it all is actually an insecurity.
Yeah.
To maybe overcome something else that's going on in their life, you know, maybe it has nothing to do with the horse. But again, back to your question, if somebody was coming into the sport, I would say just try to watch videos, go to races and pick out someone you like and just really watch them, and then try to ask them for help if they'll help you. But it's this sport is tough because of that. Like you said, you know, you could get in with the wrong trainer and learn everything wrong. And once you get bad habits, they're hard to break.
Yeah.
And another thing is ride as many horses as you can. If you're going to go out and buy a horse, don't buy the first one you ride. Go and try 20 horses, 30 horses, and then you're going to really see the difference in the horses. You're going to be able to feel differences, and then you can go back and buy the one that you think is right for you.
Yeah, because I don't know if you saw it or not, but this girl made a post on Facebook talking about this horse she had. She had put everything into it. She had done all this stuff, and they just weren't getting anywhere. And, you know, she didn't want to give up on her, which is totally honorable. I get that. But everybody replied back and said, just sell the horse. Sell the horse and get you one that you can click with and you're going to actually grow with. So, what do you think about that as far as having a horse? Like, if somebody's got a horse and they're just giving it everything that they've got, they've tried all of these things and it's obviously not working, do you think they should just get one?
I see this. I've been asked this a lot, and I have a couple of things. This may get a little lengthy, but I got a story for this that I even tell at my clinics. Back when I was just out of college and working for the government, I had a friend. Her name was, I'll say her name was Nancy to not put any names out there. But anyway, so Nancy came from a pretty wealthy family. She had this Dash for Perks horse, I think. I don't even remember what he was, but he was out of some blue hen mare, really well bred. The horse was terrible. We worked together, so we would travel together. And I remember we were coming back one day from a show, and she's like, you're out running me on this $2,500 sale barn horse. And I have this really nice horse and he's not making it. And I said, you know what? You have money. Your family has money. You have a 5-year-old daughter. Just go buy the horse you want. You want a pro rodeo? Go buy it and enjoy your life. I can't do that because I don't have the money, but you do. So do it.
Yeah.
And she said, yeah, but people will judge me that I couldn't make him work. And you know, she had a brain aneurysm and died, and he was still in her barn. And she never got to go to those pro rodeos that she had dreamed about going to and things like that. So what I tell people is, unless you are a professional trainer, unless you do this for a living, change the horse, because you have school, kids, jobs, husbands, you have so many other responsibilities in your life that this should be fun. And if it's not fun, then you're doing something wrong. And a real horseman and somebody with true horsemanship understands when that horse is limited and it's time to move on.
Yeah.
So it's just move on, because the second you get that next horse that's fun, you're going to totally forget about the other one. And because you had to give up on one, it doesn't make you a bad trainer or a bad rider.
Right.
In my opinion, it makes you a good horseman.
Yeah.
Because you understood the limits of you and that horse, at least you and your horse together. You understood it wasn't going to work and you moved on. That is actually an intelligent horse person.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. It takes more strength to let it go than it does to hold on to it. That's for sure.
Mm-hmm. And here's the thing. Once you let it go and you get something else, you forget really quick. And my husband, he's so funny. Whenever I say, oh, I have a horse and I'm not going to sell, you know, I sell everything. I don't keep anything. And I said, I'm going to, and he said, oh, I love when you say that, because those are always the most expensive ones. And then he tells me, he said, you know, if you keep that one and you don't sell it, you may miss out on the next better one.
Yeah.
And I'm like, God, you're right. Yeah. I miss out on the next one.
Yeah.
My next one could be better.
Yeah. Very true. Very true. Now, what do you think about the weather down there? Not to totally go off rail, but I just wanted to ask you, is the weather like really crazy down there, or do you have super hot summers and really cold winter? Like, how is it?
Well, right now we're okay. So everywhere south of the equator is opposite from north of the equator. So we're in winter. We're coming into winter.
Stop it. Okay.
Yeah, so everything south. So I always get a kick into that song way back in the day when they were trying to raise money for Africa, and there's like, there's snow this year in Africa.
No, I don't remember that.
Well, there's Google. Never. There's is some. It was like I'm gonna have to move because my cleaning lady is making a lot of noise.
Oh, you're fine. We can't hear it.
So there was a song, and it was like, this year there's no snow for Christmas in Africa. Or something like that.
I'm gonna have to Google that.
There's never snow at Christmas in Africa because it's summertime.
Right.
So we're coming into winter. So what I like to say here in Brazil is we have hot and less hot season. So our winter is just less hot, but it's hot as hell here. Excuse my language.
No, you're fine.
Because it's so hot. No, it's so hot most of the time. Now, right now, we're in winter and it's perfect. It's like low 70s during the day and 50s at night. Oh, but we only get this, but we only get this for like 6 weeks.
Oh, wow.
And then it's back to hot.
So your winter is 70 degrees.
Yeah.
That does, okay, well.
This is winter.
Well, at least you don't have to deal with the snow and tractors No. and ice and all of that jazz.
I don't want to go back. I don't want to go back. You know, my husband always asks me, if I pass away, will you go back to USA? No. I don't think I could winter there again, honestly. Even this time in Canada, it got to be below freezing when I was there, and that's why I got sick. I can't winter anymore.
That is crazy that you go to Canada. So do you, obviously you don't take any horses with you, or do you, I mean, you just go and...
No.
Right, so you obviously ride everybody else's horses, which is cool, but that's so cool that you go all the way to Canada and do that.
Yeah.
How long of a flight
going
is
back
that?
In the fall. Oh, it's far. It takes me from door to door about 30 hours, so almost 3 days.
Holy
a day and a half.
Well,
yeah, it's far.
So you would probably have at least a couple of layovers, right?
Yeah, usually I go from, like, I have to take a flight from my house to São Paulo, and then I go, like, São Paulo to Dallas or Chicago or wherever, and then from that place, I go to, like, Calgary or Edmonton or wherever it is I'm going.
That's pretty cool. That's really freaking cool. Now, as far as your social media following and everything that you've done on there, because that's how I found you, was TikTok. do you think that... You know, you can obviously relate to this. Back in the day, it was hard to get any type of information, like as far as not just events, but general training and general learning and stuff like that about horses. It was really hard. I mean, like, we didn't have social media. Do you think that has helped or hurt as far as you being able to kind of teach people and then other people learning more about the industry?
Well, I feel like as far as the level of the industry, it hasn't changed. And that's the thing that I see in the States compared to Brazil. It, you know, I've been here 14 years.
Oh, wow.
And I've watched the sport just go from one level to the next, to the next, to the next. And what I see in America is it's very stagnant. I haven't seen, like, that jump of being better. so I feel like as far as social media goes, I don't think that it's improved the sport. Maybe it's given it some more recognition because there's more people involved. So I think it has gotten more people involved in the sport and has grown the sport. But I don't necessarily think that it's improved the sport. Now, as far as for me living internationally, it's a game changer because I can work from here. I can live here and work there. And my social media thing has been such a blessing. Like, I never expected it to grow like it has. I get messages every day of people thanking me for the videos. And I think one thing too is a lot of people, I think some professionals just don't have time, but a lot of people are scared to tell what they know because they're scared someone may take it and beat them. But I don't have that, and I live here, and I see how the guys have helped me here and have helped me become a better trainer and rider. And I'm happy to pass that information on. You know, and I truly, everybody who comes to my clinics or anybody who sends me a message or is a subscriber, I mean, I truly have their best interests at heart. You know, I want them to succeed.
Yeah.
You know, even like the horses, I was about to make a post today. There were 4 horses in the United States that won races and rodeos this past weekend that were mine that I sold to there.
Oh, cool.
Yeah. And I'm like, that's what I want. I want people to win, and I want to stay here and watch you guys win. I don't want to travel anymore.
I mean, what do you think? I mean, Brazil's already grown, as you said. Brazil's went from here to here, and just quality is crazy. What do you think, what advice do you have for the United States for us to possibly do that, or do you think that will ever happen, you know?
Well, one I feel like, for example, we have a thing here in Brazil called the SGP. It's an entering system, and all the races use it, and so the statistics we have here are top-notch. And the statistics are free for anybody to see. And the way SGP is set up is as soon as the race is over, literally like in a second, it updates all the statistics. It does it all automatically. Now, SGP is in USA now too, but it competes against Next Gen, Saddlebook, these other entering systems. So it doesn't quite have the statistics that it could have if more people used it, for example. So here in Brazil, we have the statistics literally at the touch of our hand. So we know what to breed for. We know magic crosses. We know what, you know, is going to work. We know what's not going to work. and we can go from there. So one thing is that is pretty much every race in Brazil uses SGP. So you can follow all these live results. But like I said, the coolest thing is as soon as it's over, the entire statistical database is updated and you have access to it for free.
Right. But the United States, so,
it's kind of everywhere.
And you can't improve everywhere if you don't look at what's working and not working and how things are.
Yeah, and even like I know you have Equistat, and Equistat is great, but you can't just get online and see the stats. You know, you can't. You have to pay for a report, and when you pay for those reports, it's usually just one horse. And a lot of places don't even report to Equistat, so it's not even that. I mean, it's pretty accurate, but it's not as accurate as it could be if everybody would send their results to them.
Right.
You know.
Right.
So you have a lot of blank spaces there when it comes to results and pedigrees and things.
That sucks. You know?
Yeah, it does.
Because it's like, it's almost like, okay, well, you know, if you want to stay here, which isn't working for anybody, but nobody wants to admit it, and there could be more money, but you don't want more money, and this is what you need to do, it's almost like the United States, it's almost like just a pointless battle. Because if you sit there and go, okay, well, we're doing it better here with this, why don't you do it this way? No, we're not going to do it that way. Okay, we'll keep complaining.
Yeah, no, then. And then you get, I think it's kind of like a comfort zone. You know, and then, you know, then you have like even like the competition, you know, so you have one entering system here and another one here. Yeah. And then there's that thing. Whereas here, there's nothing that competes against SGP. It's the only one that's used. So it makes our stats so much more accurate, per se.
Yeah, makes things better.
So I don't know, you know, that's America, I think, has just gotten a comfort zone. You know, it's first world. You don't really have any problems, not real problems. So you kind of make problems. You make up problems.
I agree with you. I agree with you in such a massive way with this statement, because you are right. It can be obvious sometimes, but I don't know how to fix. We can't fix the world in one episode.
But I will tell you this. America has things that are better than Brazil, too. I can't say Brazil is better. For example, because all we do is have these professional people pretty much running.
Yeah.
There's a lot of people that don't ride their own horses because they're scared to look bad or scared to lose. Mm-hmm. And I feel like what made the sport so big in America is the amateur rider, the person who doesn't do it professionally. They're the people who buy the saddles and buy the trailers and buy the trucks. And, you know, they're the ones that make the industry what it is.
Yeah.
You know, and so here in Brazil, I had a talk with the association about it. Like, you guys need to do something for the amateur riders, because it's just getting less and less and less and less. And they're just letting the trainers run the horses.
Yeah, I guess there's a catch-22 for everything, you know, because you are right. Mm-hmm. We talked about this in another episode. You got to have the little guy to have the big guy. You got to have the big guy to have the little guy, and it all kind of works together, you know, because we were talking about.
Yeah, and here you don't have that. Here you don't really have that. So what happens is you get a lot of horses. For example, I had a guy call me today and offer me a horse for sale. And it's a Trace Ace out of a big-time Dash to Fame mare here in Brazil. And he's already started and going, he's 3-year-old, and they want to sell him because they know he's not going to run like a 16-2 on a standard pattern. They're like, well, we think he's going to top out at like 17-0, 17-1, and that can't win here, so we want to get rid of him.
Aww.
You know, so okay, I'll probably buy him because those are the type of horses that I can put my little handle on them, get them turning with one hand instead of two. Take them to some rodeos and then sell them to the United States and make a 1D horse, you know?
I was just going to ask you about that. You're probably really familiar with the whole import-export of animals process.
Yes.
Like, you sell a lot.
Yeah.
That's crazy, isn't it? It's a big ordeal.
It's not as big as people think. I think it's just new to the barrel racing world, you know? Because if you think of like polo, jumping, race horses, they ship horses all the time from even competitions.
Oh, okay.
I think it's just new to the Western world. The idea of bringing, oh my gosh, an American quarter horse from another country. Why would we do that?
Yeah.
But America doesn't quite have the breeding programs that Brazil does. And in Brazil, for a horse to come here, it had to qualify. You know, we can't just buy and bring anything here. So these guys have bought the best brood mares, the best stallions. We have semen from all the best stallions. And they have such big breeding programs Most of them have a repro vet on staff, on salary. And so the bloodlines of these horses, it just evolves super fast. Everything that runs down the alleyway here is top-notch bred. Everything.
What do you mean it has to qualify to come into the country? Like, they won't just let anything...
No. For example, if I wanted to buy a horse in America and bring to Brazil, the rules are now that it had to have won over $30,000 in barrels. Or if it was younger, the parents had to have won over $30,000 or produced 3 foals that won over $30,000 in order for it to come.
Really?
Yeah.
This is not...
And that's for barrels. For race horses, it's $200,000, I think.
Oh, my God. And okay, that's obviously not an association rule. That's a, like, country
rule. It's an association and government rule. So
government, okay.
So the Brazilian government believes if you're going to import something, it needs to better the genetics of the animals that are already here. Wow. So that's why. So every, even cattle, sheep, anything, there's a set of rules that the government asks the main association to set. They say, okay, you want to bring in cattle, then, you know, it has to meet these requirements, because they want to protect the local breeders and they want to make sure that whatever comes in is to increase the herd, the genetics that already exists.
That is so cool. My mind is blown right now. I had no idea you could even do that. Like, well, obviously,
yeah,
you can.
Oh, and get this, when our foals are born, we don't register them. I have to pay an inspector from the association to come and register them, and I have to give him $1,200 to come for the day. And so I try to do all my foals at one time, because It doesn't matter if it's one foal or 100 foals.
Right.
His cost is just $1,200 to come to my house. And then he's the one who puts the microchip in. He's the one that pulls the hair for the DNA. And he's the one that does all the documents that he then submits to the association. And let's say, for example, it has a parrot mouth or a really bad clubbed foot. He won't register it.
Really?
And then you just have a grade horse. Yep.
That is insane. I bet you that is streamlined as hell.
It is, and it's a little bit, I mean, sometimes it depends your inspector, you know. If you've got one that's really nice and understands, he'll go ahead and, you know, and register it.
Right.
But for example, my husband with his cattle, we always have, 20, 30 head that cannot be registered and become commercial cattle.
That's correct.
Because it's the same thing with cattle.
Well, that's like, I mean, you see it on the internet when they talk about the American Quarter Horse Association and papers taking 6 months, 8 months, however long, you know, like they complain about that process. That probably does not happen down there.
No, and here, even interestingly, like if you buy a breeding from a stud, you don't get your papers until you send the copy of the invoice to the association. So it's all controlled by, Brazil has an amazing internet program for the association, way better than AQHA. Like, it knocks AQHA out of the water.
See, this blows my mind on why, if you are a company or a person or whatever have you, a country, if you see somebody else doing better, it's not a competition, but wouldn't you want to improve? Like, wouldn't you want to be up to their level? Like, if I was AQHA, I would look at that and go, we need to do better.
I think they just don't know. Honestly, like, for example, the healthcare system in Brazil, I think it is amazing, because you have a public healthcare and you have private healthcare. So like me, I have I pay every month for an insurance plan.
Yeah.
So I can go to the public hospital or to the private hospital. I can get a private doctor. But let's say I don't have insurance. I can go to the public hospital, and the doctors usually work at both hospitals, so you have the same doctor. The difference is, in the public one, sometimes you have to wait in line a long time, or like if you need a non-emergency surgery, you may have to wait a few months to get it. Like, let's say you tear the cartilage in your knee. Okay, you're not going to die from that, so it may take 3 months before you get your surgery, but it's all free.
Oh,
all free.
I'll wait 3 months
now,
for free.
Yeah, but like if you do private and, you know, you have an insurance plan, if I had to do a surgery, I could get right in. And I really love that you can have both.
Yeah.
And I'm like, why can't America have both? So there's a hospital here in a city called Barretos, and it's a cancer hospital, and everything is free, and it runs off of donations. And for example, every city, like I live in a city called Mirandópolis, so every city has a house in that town, and every day there's a bus that goes from my town to that city to take cancer people to get treatments. And if they need to stay the night or stay a week or stay 2 weeks, they can stay in the city's house, kind of like Airbnb, but little bit simpler. So it's first come, first serve. It doesn't matter if you're rich or poor. And you get your entire cancer treatment for free. And so the city every year has an auction once or twice a year for cattle or sheep and pigs, whatever livestock you want to put in the auction. So ranchers donate animals to the auction. Like my husband donates a really nice bull every year. And all that money goes to the cancer hospital. So you have all these towns putting on one auction a year. All the proceeds from the auction go to the cancer hospital. So these people get cancer treatments for free.
That is so cool. And it goes directly to the hospital. That's even cooler.
Yeah.
Because now you have to worry about Goodwill and other places like that, you know, of what they're actually doing with your money, you know. So that's cool that it goes directly to the hospital.
Yeah. So the point of my whole point of the story is America is amazing. It's the best country in the world. It really is. And Brazil tries to copy it, and they love Americans. But at the same time, after living internationally for, oh my gosh, for 20 something years, I realized that we don't always have the best. We just think we are. So we don't open our eyes and see what other countries are doing that maybe we could incorporate and be better.
Right.
So I even think like the Quarter Horse Association, I don't think that they know that Brazil has such an amazing system and that they could change. I think they're just used to their system, think their system's pretty good, and just try to update it as they update it.
Yeah.
No?
Well, and you know what? You're right. I mean, you have to be grateful for certain things because you get where, no matter wherever you go, it's going to be a double-edged sword. You're going to have really good. You're going to have really bad. It's going to be pros and cons. You know, that's
100%.
Life. But it still just kind of makes you think. Okay, well, if this is more streamlined, why can't we try to do that here or whatever have you? You know,
because the technology exists.
Yeah.
So you know, it's like, come on, AQHA. Even me, I submit a bunch of documents to get the AQHA papers of these Brazilian horses, and I basically just hand it to them, like everything ready. I'm like, okay, you just need to hit print.
Just do it.
You know, and they take forever. And then I don't know what's going on there, but for the last couple of times, they put the wrong owner on the horse, and I'm like, that is not me. Where did you even get this name, people?
I don't know. I keep hearing all these horror stories, and I'm like, is it really that hard? Like, that's crazy to me that it's that hard for them to handle that.
I don't know. I really don't know.
Now,
maybe they're watching us and get better.
Now, how long did it take you to learn Portuguese? That's the main language down there, right?
Yeah, about a year or two. Now, I spoke Italian before, and I had a little bit of French. You know, I lived in Italy for like 6 years, so I speak Italian too.
What did you live there for?
Oh, same thing. I trained horses. I left my government job and went there and trained horses and then came back to Texas.
I didn't know there were barrel horses in Italy. I knew they had reiners over there. I knew Germany has reiners and they got cutters over there in Italy too. But I didn't know they had barrel horses over there.
Yeah. Yep. It's big. It's big too.
Blew my mind.
Yeah, I'm telling you, this sport, honestly, I think it's bigger than jumping or any other sport. But because it's not organized, it's not organized like reining or jumping.
Yeah. Well, you get some money out of it, too. That's a big incentive. You know, like, obviously, you know, from show jumping and all around, just general all around showing, used to not get payouts. You didn't get, like, money like what's really...
No, and now it's a lot.
Yeah.
It's a lot now. That's why I quit jumping. Like, honestly, if I could have done what I wanted to, I would have rode jumping horses. I would have been a professional jumping rider.
Oh, really?
But I would go to shows, and I would just win ribbons.
Yeah.
And then I'll never forget when I went to my first barrel race, and I think I won, like, $46. And I was like, oh, my gosh, I'm okay. I'm done. I'm running barrels. I'm in this because I don't care how much ketchup you put on that ribbon, you cannot eat it. And I was broke and hungry, and I was like, this is money. I'm in.
You're right. No, you're right. Like, I make awards and prizes, obviously, for people, and it's the general of taking something home, which is great, but horses cost money. It's not, I mean, they cost a lot of money, so when you get a chance to get that back, hell yeah, you better do it, you know?
No, and think about it. There are barrel horses now that make more money than race horses.
Oh, wow.
I mean, I've really been paying attention to that. Look at Cassie Mowry. You know, Jarvis has won $1.8 million. Look at Sister. You know, she's, what, won $3
million? Yeah.
You know, and even look at Audios. He's won $600,000. But there are lots of horses out there that have won $100,000, $200,000, $300,000. And there are race horses that don't make that.
Well, do you think that because they are kind of aligning together in the same sense, do you think that because, you know, the racehorse industry, I had a racehorse trainer on here. She was really cool. They are so heavily regulated. I mean, when you give that horse Butte, you have to, like, write it down. Like, they are so heavily regulated.
Yeah.
Do you think that because barrel racing is still racing and there's going to be money involved and it's becoming more and more bigger money, do you think that that could be foreseen in the future, that it starts being regulated?
No, not unless there's gambling. So the reason racehorses are so restricted is because of the gambling, because people are wagering on those horses.
Maybe barrel races need to start gambling. I don't know.
Yeah, maybe they do. Yeah. but it would be so hard because, again, you still don't have a governing body to oversee it all.
Yeah.
This is what makes it hard.
Yeah, you are right. Because you have multiple associations with their hands, and then they're competing, whereas a racing horse industry in general is just kind of one thing.
Yes. Like here.
Yeah.
Here it's one thing, you know? I mean, so that's why we have the drug testing and have the rules and the different things. But a lot of it here, too, is for animal rights. We have a lot of animal rights people here. So we have to be really careful. Like, we cannot whip a horse on the shoulder. Like, when we're running, and you know how some girls hit it on the shoulder? If you do that here, you're disqualified. So you cannot touch the horse in front of the girth when you're inside of the arena.
That makes sense, though.
Because of the animal rights people. And all the time when we go to shows, there's always a big banner, like, take care of your horse. Your horse is the first priority. And the speaker will even talk about it, like, you know, be nice to your horse. Because we always know that those animal rights people could be there and they could video something and then we could not have the sport anymore.
Well, and it's common sense. Like, you can't make your money unless you have the horse. So you need to be good to the horse. That's the common sense thing. Like,
yeah,
you know.
Yeah.
Which blows my mind that people think that they can treat them shitty, but you have them out there, so it's a good thing we have the activists there. I want to ask you one more question. Mm-hmm. What could you have done differently, or what was one of the biggest lessons that you learned as far as your barrel racing training career that you wish you would have learned sooner? Like, what's one of the biggest things that just kind of took you a while to get that you wish you would have learned sooner?
How to teach a horse balance and have my horse broke. I thought my horses were broke till I moved here. I thought my horses had balance till I moved here.
Oh,
and,
wow.
I think if I could have known about balance and a better broke, I would be even further along in my career than I am now.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, I would have to say that. And even when I do these clinics and get on all these horses and watch videos, I feel like in America in general, obviously there are people out there that know what they're doing. In general, the American barrel racer and Canadian barrel racer do not know how to teach a horse balance. The horses aren't balanced. And I think this is why you have not even so much the fitness. The fitness is one thing too. Like, the horses are fat. I'm sorry, but the majority are fat. And when you're fat, it's hard to have balance. So when you are fit and you have balance, the things that these horses can do will blow your mind. Where they can put their feet and move their bodies and do things is something that I only learned here, and actually only really started to really get it even here about 6 years ago. And it's incredible.
I'm so glad you said that, because I'm sure you know who John Lyons is. He was like one of the first, ages ago. That's when I rode. I remember when he first come up, and he was the man. Like, he was like the only person that did clinics, and he like introduced leg boots. So, I remember him distinctly saying one time that the horse is able to give like 900 and something physical maneuvers, but the human can only get them to do like maybe 50 or 75 of them. And you know, I remember him distinctly saying that somewhere, some way, in a magazine or something. You know, you don't have that nowadays. And I thought, even like when you see discussions on the internet where people are like, you know, you buy this horse and it's not going to be able to do this or not going to be able to do that. Well, no, technically it can. It just might not be what is socially acceptable or, you know, or whatever have you. But physically, like mechanically, the horse can actually do it depending on its conformation and things of that nature, you know.
And I think Americans and Canadians get stuck into tradition.
Yeah.
It's traditional. We do this. It's tradition. Whereas I think me being around the world and seeing other cultures and languages and riding all different kinds of horses, I'm always like, there's a way. There's got to be a way to tweak this. There's got to be a different way. And when I get on clinics and get on these horses, I tell everybody, you guys, you don't freak out. I'm going to do stuff you've never seen before. It works. And it does. It does work.
Yeah, but you are right. People will freak out. Oh, they're like,
Lucy.
No, they're like, they'll freak out. It's almost like, you know, we were talking about.
I'm sorry, I'm gonna go.
You're fine. What is it? What do you got? Ducks or chickens?
No, it's guineas.
Hey, geese.
It's guineas, and they think I'm their mom.
Aww.
And they came up, so I gotta go in my house now.
No, you're fine.
Because they saw me.
Oh.
I have to hide from the guineas.
No, I'm cool that you said that, because you are right. Like, we can get stuck into the whole confirmation, which, yes, that obviously has something to do with it. A mini's not going to jump 3 feet. We get it. But, you know, like, but if you wanted to train a mini horse to have a collected slow lope, it technically could do it if you did it right. You know, like, it, you know. I had a girl on here one time. She's really big into cowboy dressage, and she kind of said the same thing. She's like, I could take that 17-hand horse into the cutting pen. It's not going to look that good. It's not going to be what you're used to seeing, but technically, it could do it. And you're right. I think a lot of people just, like, that just goes over their head.
Yeah, it's just like the stretching. I call it the horse yoga or horse Pilates. You know, here in Brazil, we stretch riding them, and we make that rib cage move and get that. Like when I go to the clinics and I get on the horses, I stretch them, and then I work them to actually start to move behind the wither, like open the shoulder behind the wither, and really get that rib cage rolling from side to side. And it's why I made that one video. Like, I think the reason why we don't have such a problem with bleeding, and this is just my theory, is we stretch that rib cage so much that when the horse breathes, he can expand. And I'll never forget, I was in Canada and we did all this, and a lady made a run on her mare. And when she got done, she said, "Oh my gosh, Shannon, my mare just took the biggest breath I've ever felt, and my legs just spread apart." She said, "I've never felt that before." And I was like, you know, if your rib cage is stiff, those lungs can't expand out. They have to expand like lengthwise and not sidewise. And I was like, this is just one of my theories, but it could be the reason why there's so many bleeders in America and not hardly any here that I've seen. It doesn't mean horses don't bleed here. They do, but nothing like I see there. And it's hot here. It's dusty here. You know, it's not because of our altitude. I think it's, one, our horses are really in top-notch shape. But two, I think because we have that fascia of that rib cage so open and expandable that when that horse does breathe, those lungs have somewhere to go.
You are right, now that you think about it, and it's not probably going to get fixed anytime soon, because people are just quick to slap something on top of it. Like, they don't want to listen to or open their mind up to what you're saying, the actual physical, you know, or the situation of the horse. Like, oh, okay, that does make sense. But you're right, here they're just going to slap something over it.
But it's interesting, you know, I put it on my subscriber page, and everybody's doing it, and I've been getting messages left and right about how much better their horse feels.
That's awesome. So, no, that's good.
Yeah,
that's a good
thing.
Yeah,
it's really good. It's really cool.
Well, because you just made me think, because I was like, well, she actually makes sense there. I don't even run barrels, but that kind of makes sense. Like,
yeah.
Okay. But then the pharmaceutical companies wouldn't make any money.
No. But, you know, I cure a disease here called pyroplasmosis. It's a tick disease that we have here in Brazil that in order to be imported into the United States, they have to be negative from. So I actually cure that disease in these horses before I export them. And in this process of doing this, I've learned a lot about the liver of the horse and the overall, like, health of the horse as far as blood exams and things, because the medicines we give can be really hard on their liver.
Yeah.
So we're pulling blood liver enzyme exams about every 90 days on these horses. And I don't think girls realize that, you know, you're giving Dex and Lasix and Banamine and you're getting maybe a short-term fix, but you're going to be in trouble in the long term and you may not realize it.
Yeah.
And when your horse's liver enzymes start to go high and when his liver starts to fail, the symptoms mimic a lot of things like maybe EPM or a horse that just doesn't feel too good and the vets can't figure out what's wrong. His overall health starts to decline. And then that actually opens up for him to have a lower immunity and then contract other diseases, you know?
Yeah, no, I completely agree with you. That's why I say what I said, you know, like you can't, same thing with horses, you can't make money off of sick people. And unfortunately, people only care about making money sometimes and it sucks, but you know, that's the uphill climb. But it's a good thing that you have what you're putting out there, the information that you're putting out there for people to be like, oh, okay, maybe we can do something better here.